Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin. With guest co-host
Darkest Onion.
Civ Rev 2 got released on Android. What's next?
Yep, there we go.
There's not much more to say than that.
Yes, it was good to acknowledge that. We talked about Civ Rev 2 at length before, and then it was not available on Android, and now that it is.
Yes.
So.
Well, this is Darkest Onion, here to visit again. Dan Q.
What?
Mad Jin. Makalua.
What?
What?
Now in all the cities. I just like that Imagine answered after you said Makalua.
Instead of a certain one giving him wings, it's giving him blah, 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 blah.
Exactly.
So we got an email from Matt, and he asks, "Hi, I've noticed the predominance of BE topics over BMW topics lately, which makes sense. I was just wondering, what does the future look like? Does the release of the new game mean that BMW topics will not be discussed just as you stopped discussing Civ 4 when Civ 5 came out? Once again, it would make complete sense to do that. I would just rather know for sure rather than skim through the show description every time looking for Civ 5 topics. Thank you, Matt."
I responded to that in an email, by the way, but I felt it was important to bring up on the show. Polycast's gaming coverage is to continue to include Civilization V as well as Civilization Beyond Earth. Of the 25 Polycast episodes published in 2014 thus far, at least one Civ 5 topic was included in all but four of them. Looking into the immediate future, there is to be a Civilization 5 topic on episode 216, recording this Saturday, so what we're doing right now, and actually there's two of them. But then I also told him that an episode 217 to be published on the 31st of December is to focus near exclusively on it, and I can tell you it focuses exclusively on it. In correction of one point you made, however, Civilization 4 coverage was not dropped upon Civ 5 release in 2010. Last year, a Civ 4 topic was a part of episode 177, but more significantly, going back to 2012, one or more Civ 4 topics appeared in 15 episodes. That was more than half of the total, as well as on the Christmas special. On a related front, the upcoming annual listener feedback survey is to include a standing multiple choice question about the Civ title balance coverage audience members think is best. So in addition to emails such as yours, input provided through said survey is to have an impact on Polycast content as well as structure. I hope that you will participate in it. I thank you for taking the time to raise your concern for response and for continuing to listen to the show.
Simple answer, we'll just keep talking about both until we get bored of one or the other. So,
yeah, I like talking about both games, but I burnt out on Civ 5 for a while, so I was just enjoying the whole BE conversation for a few months.
And when Civilization 5 came out, there were some concerns that drove a number of regular co-hosts, primarily, if not exclusively, to go back to Civ 4 for a while, as well as we got some comparable feedback from our audience, and it was kind of reflected in the community how much was being talked about Civilization 4 versus Civilization 5 still. Now, does that mean we're going to take a cookie-cutter approach with regards to Beyond Earth?
Cookie?
No. Not only is it a different title, I mean, it's not a direct line. It's like a cousin to the main title. We have Civilization Beyond Earth instead of Civilization 6. This is not Civilization 6.
It's not the main course. It's kind of like not an appetizer, but something in between.
So as promised in the email, and as I kind of amended my response verbally here, not only do we have one, but two Civilization 5 topics to start with. From Mega Bears Fan, published in November, India, quote-unquote, sorely misunderstood in Civilization 5. Preface, one of, if not the most sorely misunderstood civilizations from the vanilla game, Gandhi's India. We're not specifically talking about this because of the argument that it has been generally misunderstood, but rather we have not talked about India since the release of Brave New World, actually, let alone the fall patch. India received a very minor tweak in Brave New World. Its unique building was modified to provide tourism instead of gold, but the new trade route mechanics will radically change the way that India should be played. In some ways, the new features make India feel like a completely new civilization. Gandhi's representation in Civilization V gets a lot of undeserved criticism from some players who often cite India as the quote-unquote worst civ in the game based solely on the fact that he is the only civ with a penalty explicitly stated in his unique ability, except for Venice and Brave New World. The population growth ability itself is very poorly understood. Many players assume that this means that India must be played with a small empire and that India cannot compete for any victory except for culture or diplomacy. This is simply not the case. Now, this article focuses on more than just the population growth aspect and the resulting rejigging, refocusing of what you're thinking about in terms of trade with India as a with response to the changes in the trade route mechanics from Brave New World. Mega Bears fan does go into some math. Oh no, fatal exception error. Everybody on reboot. We're good now. But again, just to remind our audience, population growth, again, is a unique ability for India. Unhappiness from number of cities doubled, but unhappiness from number of citizens halved. Because if you stop to do the math, you'll see that as your cities grow, the positives will quickly outweigh the negatives, regardless of how many cities you have. The only thing you want to avoid with Gandhi is founding cities in places where they won't grow. Pace your expansion, and you'll do fine. With Brave New World's internal trade routes, Indian cities can grow faster to take advantage of population growth. Combined with the extra happiness sources that Gods and Kings had introduced, and India can easily be the happiest civilization in the game, regardless of its size.
Well, I found the article kind of an interesting perspective on how to play Gandhi in more than four cities, but it seemed to me it's not that you shouldn't play them with number of cities. You should play them with three or less because that's the easiest way to play them. Doing anything else, all the math that he provides just kind of hints at if you wanted to play them in a way they're not designed to be played, here's the way to get around it.
He does focus on that specifically standard size maps are smaller, where he notes that the extra unhappiness that is generated by a city is completely offset by the reduced unhappiness from population once the city reaches 6 pop.
Mm-hmm.
And since the unhappiness per city does not increase based on the number of cities that you own, this ability scales with any sized empire.
Mm-hmm.
He does say, however, that having easy access to multiple distinct luxuries is critical to India's expansion desires. If you get stuck on a map that doesn't offer a wide array of available luxuries, then you will find that India will have trouble expanding.
As per usual.
Right. I mean,
most people have trouble expanding if you don't have a wide array of luxuries on it.
The happiness problem.
Yeah. You just have to remember to grow your cities to the point where you're starting to use local happiness from population to offset global from cities.
Well, I tend to run domination in Civ 5, and for me, India is just not the first choice. I mean, I'd rather play Shaka if I was going to go down that route.
Depends on when you want to fight.
True.
Fuzzy Fractal asks in the chat, so the rate of pop growth outweighs the cost of new cities.
I mean, the biggest problem with India is the same problem with the game itself. It's much harder to go from, say, 10 to 20 pop than it is to go from 1 to 10 in a new city. So new cities will always grow way faster than older cities. So you can't necessarily drive pop growth to get your happiness.
Yeah, you can only do so much.
Yeah. Plus, you can only get one pop per turn at most.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, you'll quickly run past these trade routes.
Ah, speaking of the trade routes, to expand on that, what Mega Bears fan has to say, send as many food trade routes as possible to your own cities in order to grow them as large as possible, as quickly as possible. This is the opposite of civs like Morocco, Arabia, and Germany, who all benefit from sending trade routes to foreign cities. Focusing on maintaining friendships and alliances with as many maritime city-states as possible will also boost your growth. And another strategy for minimizing the effect of the double unhappiness penalty is to wait to found a new city until you enter a golden age, as while in a golden age, happiness has no effect. Part of what he's saying, of course, when I read that is, yes, you're not going to be accumulating happiness points towards the next golden age. So he says it doesn't matter if that new city will push you over the edge into negative happiness.
Yeah, I mean, even if it did put you into negative happiness, it'd only slow down getting to that next golden age, so it's not really that much of an issue.
Right. He also noted that you need to make sure not to overdo India's trade routes by making them food trade route dependent for the rest of the game. Don't found a city that's going to need supplies, basically.
Well, yeah, you shouldn't put a city somewhere and then send all your trade routes to it just to keep it alive. That's right. Kind of a waste of all those trade routes.
I could see if you're really feeling want and need for a particular strategic resource, of course, always depending upon your victory condition, that you might found a city as India or, I mean, just generally anybody, and you realize it's really not going to grow that much, but I need it for that strategic resource, or maybe I need it for that strategic location, like a chokehold, for example. And then, well, you just have to take into account that as India, you're going to have to be doing something to try to combat the unhappiness, maybe just a little bit more than you would otherwise. There's actually a benefit to having my cities as India larger than maybe they would otherwise be for another civilization because the unhappiness from number of citizens is halved.
The main point in there is don't drop a city that's going to require tributes to stay alive. So if you do drop a city somewhere that, because you want a strategic resource, it's going to be more of a penalty to India earlier in that city's life because you have more unhappiness from the city itself than you would from the population. And to get it up to that minimal 6 pop, if you have to leave a trade route there to make sure that that city is still growing, then there's something bad going on.
Well, I also thought about how his article would apply to playing above king. Now, I play Emperor Plus, and I try to picture a deity game trying to follow his strategy. I'm not sure if it'd fit.
Don't think it's got much of an issue. Grow. Plant city, grow. I agree with them that Gandhi's not as bad as some people try and make it out to be.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely been part of the dissing of India, air quotes, but I've never said that it was the worst. And I would never say it was the worst. That's far too extreme.
I'd be careful. I don't like to put any sieve in the worst bucket.
There's a worst.
Oh, I know.
Yes, the tweak in Brave New World with the unique building being modified to provide tourism instead of gold is something, but I think the biggest thing that is worthwhile reasoning why I decided to finally have us discuss this particular topic was not just because of that change, but in particular, again, the trade route mechanic, seeing as how you want to be able to get the cities that you do have up to as high a population as you possibly can quickly, especially given, as has already been pointed out, your early expansion is going to need to be a little slower because of the penalty for a number of cities as compared to other civilizations. So those internal trade routes are going to help you, plus the fact that, particularly in the early game, as we've discussed on the show before, they're probably the safest trade routes in the sense of the least likely or at least less likely to be squished by barbs, whether on the coast or by land. Because it's easier for you to protect it than you know, the entire length of that route. Or at least it should be, and in which case, make certain you're able to protect it before you establish it. And that's regardless of whether you're India or anybody else, but just thought it was worthwhile mentioning again.
Yeah. Well, based on the expansion plan, since you are going slower between expansions, mostly, obviously a religion that gives you extra happiness kind of smooths over the whole thing. But otherwise, you may want to spread your cities out a little bit more than you might otherwise, just because it is going to be a slower expansion, so you want to claim more land per city, prevent the AI from getting too much extra in there, and provided you're not going insane amount of specialist happy, you're going to want to have land for that population to work. And if you're going to put them really tall, then you might as well have more land. Because, frankly, those guys that just give you a point of production, yeah, they aren't that useful.
And that combined with the fact you're probably going to have to go farther afield than you would otherwise with another civilization just for the fact that, okay, I need another unique luxury that I don't already have. Oh, it's all the way over there, so that just kind of fits with that as well.
Yeah, that depends on the map. Sometimes there's a monopoly of one particular resource in your area, other times not. Possible options that you have is just take your war elephants and go take out city-states near you if they're not, you know, maritime for the food side of things. Just go take them out if they have a different type of luxury.
Yeah, and if you find that you have a monopoly on a particular resource, then cultivate some early-game friendships and trade.
Yes, trade lots.
Trade is good.
If you have the internal trade routes, it doesn't mean that you don't have really kind of any diplomacy going on. It can just be, and again, yes, this is map dependent as well, but don't think, oh, I have this surplus of ivory and next to nothing else, so I guess I'm SOL restart. Well, no, continue to explore, find some other civs, and see if they have extras of uniques that they are willing to trade with you. And the sooner you do that, the sooner you're going to be able to cultivate a positive relationship, because from early on in the game, you have a trading relationship. And that might be the difference between someone not declaring on you as declaring on somebody else.
Yeah, just be careful, because if all your happiness is based on trade and then the AI decides, hey, let's
sabotage the player.
Yeah, And then all of a sudden you're completely unhappy because you don't have all those luxury resources that you've been trading.
Yeah, that's kind of the macro scale of putting all your eggs in one basket as opposed to the micro of, okay, I need to send all of my trade routes to this one city, and they must always go to this one city in order to ensure that it keeps growing and maintains this really high population. Mega Bears Fan also says that it is highly recommended that an Indian player should invest in faith early in the game. Religions can provide many growth and happiness benefits that India can take excellent advantage of. So yeah, let's see some cathedrals, some mosques, some pagodas. Mm-mm-mm. There's another source of happiness for you.
Yeah, and with Gandhi, if you're going tall, then anything that gives you plus per pop based on population can be very, very favorable if you're actually going to grow. So tithe and stuff like that.
But yeah. The Star of Hope in the chat says, happiness does become readily available as you hit ideologies now, though, and that takes some of the strength away from India, in my opinion. Well, I don't know if it takes away some of the strength necessarily, as maybe in the mid to late game, it's kind of, okay, some of the other civilizations, but it helps India, too.
Yeah, well.
I think what he's trying to say is, assuming one it's dials at 10 volume for India, I think he's just saying that when everybody else gets a chance, the dial gets dialed back a bit. For them, but it's still a benefit. It's still positive.
Well, and India still has that.
The question of, did you go to the same ideology that everybody else did? Because while you might get a lot of happiness, if you went for one that's not the same as everybody else, you're going to start losing happiness.
Because India, you get a pulse on what's going on in terms of other civs in the game, and really, India can compete for any victory type. You can adopt whichever ideology best suits your needs and playstyle, quote-unquote, which definitely includes what's going to piss off people less, or better yet, not piss people off. Whether you get to an ideology first or not, I mean, if you can get the ideology first, great, then you have, you know, a better chance of exerting that influence and getting other civs to adopt your ideology. But if you need to switch, it's not going to be, oh, I really needed to go this ideology for this particular path that I want to go down with India. India's versatile enough. You'll be all right.
Yeah. They're not a weak civ by any sense. And that's why I don't understand the whole worst idea. Problematical is what I would say.
Yeah, I think the idea of the weakest comes from initially a cursory glance, which, as Mega Bear Fan said at the start, it's explicitly stated as part of its unique ability, a penalty, which is the unhappiness for a number of cities doubled. And everyone's like, whoa, 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 walking the other way, okay, thanks. Especially with all of the other choices, not just with Vanilla, but since Gods and Kings and Brave New World, more civs and more civs to choose from, that I think people have even gotten farther and farther away from decrying India as the worst to just ignoring India altogether.
Got a loss in the shuffle, maybe.
Yes.
No. The point is, Gandhi also has that whole little adjustment to it as well. And I think everybody gets it, but with Gandhi, it's a little weirder. So unhappiness from pop does cap out at like 75%. It's not a pure one pop, one unhappiness sort of thing. So in each city, there is a cap. And it's built so that population happiness can cover the city by itself without luxuries.
Well, other people also have said that they've avoided playing India because you have to do some math to understand. Okay. And no, it bothers people. I don't even like it. But I do it.
Yeah, I think there is some of the initial investment of the math there, but once you start playing India, you get kind of a general feel for it, and you don't have to break out the spreadsheet constantly every single time you play as India. It's just like with any civilization, really.
Well, the same thing when, like, the first launch, I just got suddenly like, oh, I get the gist from the feel of playing it. More than, like, studying the math.
I'll do it. I'll do it. Boo! You said you can play Civ game without spreadsheet.
Spreadsheet make better.
Another Mega Bears fan article, a more recent one, actually.
Yeah, this time we're going to talk about Germany.
I have a way of playing Germany, but I will participate.
He titled his new one, Bismarck Conquers the Brave New World Through German Engineering.
Very thorough article, I'll give him that. Very, very number crunchy and good.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that they had taken the Landsknecht neck away from being specifically a German thing, put it into the
commerce, social policy.
It seems late game talk about Brave New World changing Germany and calling it more rounded. I don't know. I almost feel like buffing an already formidable civilization.
Adjusting.
Yeah, since they took away the Landsknecht and they gave him this bank things like that's sort of a replacement. Now we're going to tweak a couple other things while we're here. I guess they wanted to make sure everybody got a pass.
The unique ability, which translates to ferocity of the Germans, upon defeating a barbarian unit inside an encampment, there is a 67% chance you earn 25 gold and they join your side and pay 25% less for land unit maintenance.
It's that last part. It's not so much getting it out of the barb camps, it's that 25% persists even later on.
Yeah, that first sentence, if your luck skill is bad.
Why you have no luck skill?
Gotta put points in the luck skill.
Yeah, I'm bad with luck. That's why when I first played Germany, I never noticed the free army effect. I never got any units.
Mega Bears fan says, it is important to note that maintenance discount applies to all military land units, so all your ranged, mounted, and siege units will also be discounted. This makes the German discount more beneficial than the Zulu's unit discount, since Germany can maintain a much more diverse set of units, and the discount still applies to your gunpowder and mobile units in the latter half of the game. But despite the maintenance discount, Germany can still suffer from excessive maintenance costs, so keep an eye on your gold per turn as you assimilate barbarian units to your side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd watch Germany do a lot of runaway after Brave New World. A lot of it. If I just sit back and let them.
Well, exactly. Don't sit back and let them.
Kill them. Kill them now.
It's kind of like with India. Okay, you want to get rid of them early because if they continue on, especially with the flavor mechanic towards nukes, if you tick Gandhi off.
You'll get a lot of nice, warm, glowing hugs.
Right. Right.
Exactly. In the case of Germany, maybe, it depends how close you are, of course, and just how many units they do decide to field and whether or not...
They'll come over for dinner.
Yeah, whether they go to you or not, if you allow them to unchecked, if you're just like, oh, they're not picking on me, they're picking on the guy on the other side of me.
Right.
Yeah, well, then they're going to gobble up another civ very early on, and that just gets back to the snowball effect that we talk about. India, we were talking a lot about with regards to trade routes. To your cities. Well, you get to the mid to late game, and we now get the Hansa, which is the unique German bank replacement, plus 5% production for each trade route your civilization has with a city-state, and trade routes other players make to a city with a Hansa will generate an extra 1 gold for the city owner, and the trade route owner gains an additional gold for the trade route as well. So, the trade route does not need to originate from the same city in which the Hansa is built, and the trade routes do not have to be unique city-states, in contrast to Morocco.
Mm.
All trade routes with city-states count for the Hansa bonus in all cities with a Hansa. If you have to, you can have every one of your cities send a trade route to the same city-state, and every city with a Hansa will benefit from all those trade routes. And seeing as how if you get to that point in the game, you probably still have a substantial number of units, as you otherwise would have, even if you disabled some, this is nice to help avoid your economy going on the crapper.
Hmm.
Or at least be not quite so muted, shall we say.
I kind of enjoy the Hans coming in because it shows kind of the economic power. You look at the history of Germany in its early days.
You put your trade routes on a city-state, so just hope that Austria is not around to soak them up, or Venice. But then just mass production.
Yeah, I was looking at it. It's like 5% production per trade. I'm going, whoa, that's a big bonus.
It takes a long time.
Not well-rounded, but a little more powerful.
Well.
Why I backed away.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does, but it's also available just essentially in the second half of the game, which is a good thing.
Yes.
Given what they get in the early part of the game, that's good for balance right there.
And the second half of the game is shorter than the first half of the game.
And with this bonus, it will be even shorter.
Yeah, it just depends on what you're doing. If you want to fight for world control for that little other thing that shows up halfway through the game, for the diplomacy side of things. So as the UN comes in, you've got all the other stuff that you can just toss production at. And, you know, if you've got
the World's Fair.
Yeah, stuff like that. You can toss more production at those, which is very useful if you want to go that way, depending on the bonuses that is. And since, you know, you're throwing all your trade routes at city-states, there's a good chance that you might actually be able to keep some of them as allies. And get those.
True.
Germany can, instead of using that production for stomping everybody with panzers, you can also just use that production to
stomp everybody with culture.
Yeah, super infrastructure.
Culture and diplomacy.
That seems like turtling and taking too long for my playstyle, though.
It depends on how you want to play.
Playstyle, yeah.
Well, you never know. I mean, some of those projects are useful for things other than playing peaceful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Germany to me is like ebbs and flows. Early on in the game, it's, okay, let's be aggressive. Now, does that mean you're attacking other civilizations? Not necessarily. It could just mean you're aggressive and going and finding barbarian camps and settling cities and the land grab, essentially, to then go into the second half of the game, which, yeah, you could continue down with, again, going back to panzers, or you could be going for another victory condition. That early snowball effect, if you can capitalize on it correctly with Germany, means that you set yourself up to be able to respond to pretty well anything else the rest of the world's going to throw at you.
Mm-hmm.
I try to picture myself playing Germany for, like, culture victory. I guess you could do it, but it never occurred to me to pick that civ if I'm picking. I go random, usually.
Thank you.
We have Civilization Online soon. That's what they say. Very soon. Why is Korea getting it first? Because it's in Korea. This is the Games in Asia thing. It's free to play, but has monetization, of course. The character design is certainly interesting for a Civilization game.
Yeah. I know, I had high hopes when I first heard about this product, but they fall slowly when I hear the phrase, only in one market. And then an MMO, and I'm like, I've enjoyed those. And then I'm like, free to play too? Okay, tell me more. And then they're like, oh, by the way, heavily monetized. I'm like, you're just losing me piece by piece.
Yeah, but it's free to play, so you can give it a look and probably drop it inside a couple hours. Well, but if it's good, then it's a pleasant surprise.
I would hope so. I mean, I've played some good ones, but monetization is not bad in itself. It's that it gets carried away within itself with a lot of companies. It starts out nice, then gets ugly fast, like Star Trek Online did it.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm really not a fan of the pay-to-win stuff. That hurts me.
Well, they said when they first went to their free-to-play model that they would only build cosmetics. They brought out a brand new starship day one, and it was the most expensive thing in the store, equivalent to $30 US, and had special weapons and did more damage than anything in the game.
In the case of Civilization Online, reporting for Tech in Asia, Marianne Lee says that, yeah, they're going for the free-to-play model right now with regards to Civilization Online, but not pay to win. But they're also not ruling out a subscription model. The 2K Games producer, Garrett Bittner, says that if the game changes or the audience changes, it's something we would certainly look into. And I'm thinking, well, I'm pretty sure the game is going to still be changing because A, it's not released yet, and B, it's going to live in a persistent online world. So I think that just kind of lends itself to changes. But, you know, I guess I kind of get what they're going for there. And I know it was mentioned about where this is going to be available, which is South Korea, at least initially. And we'd heard that before, and it makes some sense in some respects because XL Games, the developer, they're based in South Korea. Massively multiplayer online role-playing games are very popular in Asia. And the thing that was new from this article, though, was that 2K has said that if they were to publish Civilization Online elsewhere, they would outsource it to another publisher.
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, I understand why XL Games would be like, hey, if you want to be dealing with this 2K outside of South Korea, that's entirely up to you because that's going to be your deal. And I'm just thinking, 2K, are you not large enough that you would be able to go to another market yourself? I kind of scratched my head why they would even be saying that at this point when they've said all along it's only going to be available in South Korea. We'll talk about somewhere else later. Maybe the game isn't released yet. I mean, that could have just been a kind of off-the-cuff sort of thing, and it got included in the article. I don't know. Admittedly, it's not a direct quote.
Right.
It's something that, again, it's been noted by the author here on Tech in Asia. Bittner did say that we're definitely interested in continuing the traditional Civilization games. I think that what Civilization Online means for the franchise is that it's a new way to experience that same gameplay. And hey, I understand it. I've said this before about Civilization Online. 2K Games owns the Civilization IP, not Firaxis. And in fact, they own the Firaxis Game Studio. 2K is a company. They're trying to make money. We know that Civilization Revolution, I would put that in a success category. Civilization World, not so much of a success, at least from 2K standards, because they, well, shut down.
Yeah. Well, the narrative that they had on the article for Civilization Online there seemed to almost sound like 2K went shopping, and someone in South Korea went, we'll do it. And they said, how much? Good price, let's do it. The fact that they then said, if we go to put it in other markets, we're going to look for other people to do the lowest bidder for the maximum profit, which is a business model. I'm not complaining. It's just what it is. That's the subtext I got out of the article, as far as, you know, marketing.
Agreed. And I think it was also a smart move for 2K to go to XL Games because they've already done comparable games to this, rather than going to Firaxis and say, so, hey, we know we're used to the turn-based strategy genre, and we were thinking we want you to try something else. Like, to me, it's you're partnering with a company where a lot of those, well, we've been there, done that, and to apply that to Civilization, and constantly the XL Games employees have been saying that we're big fans of Civilization. And according to the lead game designer, and this is from one of the videos that was embedded with the Tech in Asia article, saying that the difference between Civ Online and Vox Civ is that rather than playing the game from a single player's perspective, you can immerse yourself in the game as a participant among tens of thousands of players who play together. And you could certainly say, well, Box Civ isn't necessarily a single-player game.
Right.
Although we know that it is, in the sense that that's where the focus of the development was, and that's how most people play it. Certainly you can play it online. I mean, that was kind of what happened with Civilization World, except it was specifically Facebook-based, and it was not a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. This is a much bigger endeavor where, quote, they're talking about tens of thousands of players who play together, where a civilization, as we've discussed before, is not just one person. You are literally one person as part of a civilization that could have tens, dozens, maybe even hundreds of people involved in that civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, I think the biggest issue XL Games is going to have is the scaling for the civilization experience.
Yeah.
Not can you have civilization experience in an MMORPG? I think you can, but how is that going to scale? How are you going to manage the number of people? Because more is not necessarily better.
Well, the thing is, the Pacific Rim companies have come up with an idea called heavy instancing. You've probably seen it in every MMO ever. When they say 10,000 people are playing, they mean, what is it, a couple thousand rooms of six people each. And then it aggregates it some kind of numbers whereby it changes what happens in the world, which is what I call false 10,000 people. Like, would you play a game with 10,000 people actually playing in your same room? I would if it didn't lag.
In the initial closed beta, and we talked about that earlier in the year, Steparoo, he had very extensive gameplay videos that he was able to show having access to that. And it was noted that it was like it was with Civilization World, which was, okay, this is when the game starts, and this is when it ends. And that's for everybody. Everybody is on the same cycle. It was noted by actually the lead game designer where he talks about that each civilization competes to win in conquest, culture, and science. And when a session ends, the process continuously repeats in a cycling format. First off, kudos to, hey, they're actually going to incorporate the different victory conditions that we've gotten used to in quote-unquote Box Civ, which is conquest, culture, and science. I guess I don't know how to interpret that. There's actually kind of mixed signals here, which is, oh, it's in the middle of a session, so I guess maybe I should wait for the start of the next session. Either that or I join an existing civilization, because if I decide to start in essentially in the middle of a game, right, it's kind of like in Beyond Earth, first 40 or 50 turns, a sponsor might land. You have an advantage by being there first. I don't know based on the wording or if it's just a translation, but, you know, my understanding was that everyone starts at the same time and they end at the same time. So you might be in different rooms, as you said, in the sense of for a particular civilization, but the world itself is one world that everybody shares, and you're just trying to get and keep a piece of it.
Well, here's what it reminded me of. His wording reminded me of multi-user dungeons from when back in the 90s, where the server resets every 72 hours. You drop in and play, right? It's a model that went away because people had problems suspending the disbelief that the whole universe resets every 3 days. So one of the problems is going to be you want to jump in and start working on the pyramids by clicking your button 70 times because it'll take you hammer stuff together, literally, as the players are playing together. And if you miss the pyramids and everyone's building the Parthenon, are you still going to play? You might miss out because you had to work that day, if it's a three-day cycle, for example.
True, and we have no idea what kind of scaling they're talking about in terms of the cycling. And I expect that's something that would maybe change from one cycle to another based on, for instance, total number of players that seem to be consistently playing, whether that's at the same time or however you measure active user, which to me, at a massively multiplayer online game, if you're not logging in at least once every 24 hours,
you're not active.
You're not an active user.
Yeah, right. And with a monetization strategy, we're also going to have to worry about the people that buy the pyramids by getting 20 people together to pay $5 in their country.
They said it's absolutely not going to be pay to win.
Right.
Well, I wonder to me, if it's not going to be pay for better things in-game, then it's okay. So if you go with the free-to-play model, then these monetization points and ideas that they have, then I guess it's aesthetics. If you're not going to do the other, and if you're not going to go to a subscription model, the only other type of model I can think of is you stick advertising in the game. But
right.
I mean, that's not going to work.
Well, you could advertise encyclopedias or something, internet equivalent, expose it with its Civ. But I just think altogether, I'll be shocked if this does well. Pleasantly shocked. The things they say sound a lot like their PR speak, and PR speak usually means we're covering up for the game being meh already.
Most of our sources for information about Civilization Online come from XL Games or 2K Games.
Right, and it's a biased source, but I try to give the people that are working on XL Games, and I don't know much about them. I'm more familiar with Perfect World, the AAA version of the Pac Rim, people that like to pick up Western products and turn them into monetized products, which is kind of surprising. I figured that's who 2K would go with, actually.
Yeah, XL Games has done fairly well with other stuff, so.
The only thing that kind of made me go, was actually the character creator.
Oh, dear. Me too, but go ahead.
From Joystick, they talk about the character creator from Elliot Lefebvre. It says, the characters here are pretty heavily stylized, but despite that, the character creator features a huge array of options, sliders, and details. And I will say, as an aside, includes accentuating certain body features.
Yeah, I'm about to say on that myself.
Why am I not surprised?
So long as it is possible for both genders, then hey, at least it's equal opportunity detailing.
That's in my line. I'm going to take a page from Saints Row, believe it or not. And if you can change, let's call it upper level body for female avatars, then if you're allowed to do that, there should be a lower body male option for manipulation.
I saw the manipulation of the female character, but that was just because I happened to be quickly scrolling through this 3 or 4 minute video and saw it, and I didn't see it for the male character.
It doesn't exist. I looked.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
The game's still in development. Maybe change that.
Well, my concern is I know a bit about the market for that type of game over there because I've played a bunch of Flip.
And they won't. It'll just be left on the female side.
And because I'm very general, they don't like discussing male stuff like that. They're uncomfortable.
Elliot Lefebvre did compare it to the grab and pull system.
Yeah, I laughed when they said that. I couldn't help.
I was like, really now? But Steparoo had said in an article that was linked to from Joystick, Civilization Online is an upcoming MMORTS RPG. A what? Yep. That's right. The game combines RTS and MMORPG together because players must work together and build their civilization empire against the other factions, featuring massive R versus R battles.
The idea of there being different civilizations, I will be very angry if the different civilization is a clan tag or a guild name and has nothing to do with any civilization whatsoever, and it's just a concentration of players that chill together called a civilization. You see what I'm talking about. It would be the easiest, cheapest way to implement it.
Hey, you want to be in the Civ NoobTube? Come on. Join NoobTube.
There you go. I'm not saying I wouldn't enjoy a funny name, you know.
Are you saying you're concerned about the possibility that Civilization Online might dilute the term civilization, like Facebook diluted the term friend?
Well, maybe. Okay, we're going for all these democratized things, like we want it on cell phones, we want it on toasters. It's nice, but at the same time, at some point, doesn't it lose its own meaning?
Well, it might lose the meaning that we understand it to be replaced with another meaning.
One last thing. They mentioned multiplayer mounts. Did anybody else catch that in passing?
Yes.
I didn't know if they're talking airship or spaceship, I would hope. But it could also be somebody riding a speeder bike or two people riding a horse. They were making a big play about how they were going to do what no MMO has done effectively before, and that's big talking.
Yeah, time will tell.
That would be awesome.
We have a poll topic in Polycast. We don't usually do these. I mean, we almost never cover polls. And it's by a Gillian Dew.
Phil managed to say that with a straight voice.
But, yeah, but which Phil meant almost always.
And I tried not to laugh.
Straight voice. I'll show you a straight voice. Anyway, when scouting for your first city, do you ignore the nearby floatstones and forward expand to get that Phyraxite? Do you mass up an army to clear those three nests to get the perfect Xenomass city? Now that the game has been out a while, which affinity do you like to play as the most? And currently Supremacy is winning with 40.91% of the votes, followed by Purity with 34.09% of the votes, and a solid 25% for Harmony.
The poll's about favorite, I suppose. So yeah, I guess... Yeah. Just for me, I'll just throw this out here. I like Purity because it's closer to Star Trek. It's completely biased. More humans doing more human recognizable things in the future. But if I have Phyraxite everywhere in my starting location, because I run retrograde thrusters, I'm going to go Supremacy. I mean, why would I ignore 30 Phyraxite? Because I promised myself I was going to use that 3 Floatstone this game. I just restart till I got Floatstone if I felt that way. Wouldn't you guys do the same?
Well, no, I know. Yeah, I agree with you. I think you can have your favorite affinity can be based thematically and mechanically. Thematically, you could view purity, like you said, Darkest Dungeon, towards Star Trek. I like purity, and that's my favorite. Of course, it doesn't mean that I ignore harmony and supremacy, because that's not true. But I like purity the most, and that's because when I reach those certain affinity levels, I like more what I see down the purity path than I do harmony or supremacy.
Yeah, and that's kind of the point of this thread. It's not about will you reload if you don't get it. That's not really the point.
Right.
No, this is more like what Promethean said in the thread. He likes supremacy, but it has his favorite affinity buildings for the optical surgery, augmentary, and hypercore being his top three.
They are nice.
He also really likes the military units, like Redeemers being very dangerous with stacking flank bonuses and the bonus versus injured. And Sabres, once it upgrades for no setup needed, is the best range unit in the game. So he likes the style of supremacy, and he likes some of the buildings in it, and that's why it's his favorite. That's more the point.
See, I'm conflicted here, because the theme of supremacy the most, but I wind up going purity the most often.
Mm-hmm. Have you read some of the stuff in Supremacy later, what they do to their people, though? It's disturbing.
It's awesome.
But it's fun. Don't get me wrong. I'm like, oh, I'm not a nice person.
Sounds ready to welcome his new robot overlords.
Yeah. I am the robot overlord.
End of line if you do not comply, kind of thing. Yep.
Exactly.
I thought the breakdown would come down a bit different on the whole poll. I thought harmony would be first because, well, frankly, it's the easiest one to get rolling. Supremacy second and purity third, because there was a lot of criticism on the philosophical possibilities under purity pre and post launch. Some people hate it with a passion as a concept. So it's kind of nice to see that it's second place, not third.
I'm big on it as a concept, but it's strong, and it's convenient. Yeah. I like convenience.
Convenient. Nothing I like going harmony and then terraforming everything.
That is fun. I've done the whole, how many Terrascapes can I afford? Let's see how much I can put down.
It occurred to me as well.
But for me, harmony is usually the easiest one to fit to a map type. I go, look at all these alien nests. Xenomass, welcome to Harmony Arc.
It just depends on the map, mostly. But yeah. Favorite-wise, I mean, Octopus is good.
I've never built one. I hear they're awesome. I always either win, or I'm not going that direction because of the map.
Yeah, that's the problem, is if you don't go that direction tech-wise, then you can kind of ignore them. Each of the affinities have one unit that's off tech by, like, a huge distance compared to the rest of their stuff.
Yeah, I'm thinking they're going to rearrange the tech web, the patch, and it's going to be a headache.
Well, I think that was by design, though. Like, there's, you just give someone a unit that you really have to go further to get it if you want it in your affinity.
I like purity right off the bat because of purity level one, where your explorers are no longer susceptible to aliens, and then I just keep going on, and once I get to level four purity, I can get battle suits, and I like the look of battle suits. I mean, there are comparable units out there. They're just, oh.
Who doesn't like Space Marines? Come on. I mean, you know, Space Marines, a little flag, sitting there going, I'm awesome.
I essentially get to Purity level 4 plus for that, and I get to Supremacy level 3, so I don't have to worry about maintenance for my roads and maglevs. I will probably have one for Harmony, and that's so that I can move my asthma. And some people are like, oh, well, it depends on the resource that I see on the map that's tied to a particular affinity. I mean, part of that's true, but as it stands right now, I like to go squished or domination, so I'm going towards battle suits. So eventually it's, I want to be able to improve that particular resource that's tied to a particular affinity so that tile can be used to its full potential.
Well,
but that's not so much for the purity itself, though. That
you are the exact opposite direction.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think I choose affinity based on the way Firaxis would like me to choose affinity.
Right. Well, I think the patch coming up is just pretty much scaring me a little bit, that we're going to see a bit of a change.
I could very easily see us revisiting this topic early in the new year, and a number of topics we've talked about beyond Earth in the new year. But just kind of like, okay, here we are right now. We're essentially at the end of 2014. The game's been out getting closer and closer to 2 months. But then, you know, we can look back and say, oh, remember when we were just so gaga over purity? Oh, we were so young.
Yes. It used to be so great before the nerf. The nerf of
2014. Yes.
It got blizzarded.
It got Civ 5 horsemen.
Somebody was arguing.
Phil, it's too soon for that.
That was a long time ago now, actually.
No, Phil, it's too soon.
Yes.
And it's sad. Biomes. There's also those two.
There's biomes in the game. Yeah.
What?
Another poll.
No, there's not two. There's three.
Yes, there are three, and they're actually fairly evenly split in the poll. I'm surprised. I was actually thinking maybe Fungal would be ahead, but it's actually Lush by a little bit. But Air is right behind it.
Yeah, I was thinking Fungal would actually be way behind, because there was a lot of complaints that Fungal Mask...
Oh, its visibility part?
Too blue, too blah, blah,
well,
blah.
I think it was going to be ahead because it was the most sci-fi-ish kind of thing.
Yeah, it's the most different.
Matt, I have trouble seeing Miasma without looking at the tooltip outside of Lush. Worse on the Fungal map for me. But I can still do it, because I'll click over on the... Oh, my God, am I in Miasma? Right?
See, I never have that problem.
Well, I have failing eyesight, probably. I probably need to get checked for that. I mean, I'm just being stubborn. But other players have said that the Lush looks too Earth-like, so it seems just the same.
And you see, to me, I viewed that as an... I'm not surprised by this poll result at all, with Lush being in first, because for all the, oh, Lush looks too much like Civilization V, there's so much that is different in Beyond Earth that just for some kind of sense of familiarity, that even if it was just subconscious, that people would gravitate towards Lush, at least initially. See what this is like in a few months.
Yeah, I mean, it's ahead by exactly one vote, and third place is exactly six behind it. So
that's what I'm saying. It's extremely close. I actually put in Arid because that, of course, we have siege worms in Dune and all that. Yeah, but it also has more of a desolate feel. It feels more like I'm trying to build a thing on just the most convenient planet that would support life we found. Like, we didn't go out of our way to find a new Eden or something.
Yeah.
It's just, this is what we got, guys. We got to roll with this.
It's a whole Beyond Earth Survivor edition kind of feel.
Yes.
One person that brought up the idea of more varied biomes in the future. Expansions, I suppose he's talking about. El Caballarian?
Sounds right.
Talked about a possible frozen biome like Hoth and Empire Strikes Back, and I can do that, a frozen biome. But also, they talked about, way back before release, that people couldn't handle a red forest or a green ocean or a yellow sky.
Guys, actually, I think we could.
I think we can. I mean, the focus testing says people are not capable.
Well, but they didn't say that it's not capable in general. It's just because it's so different.
They want to sell more copies.
Yeah.
Red barrels must explode, not green barrels, is the argument.
Yeah.
If that ocean was yellow, I'd go, oh, great, that's probably not water. Now I understand why the boats don't go in it at first.
Yeah.
That could be sulfuric acid. That would take some development time.
On the last episode of Polycast, they responded to questions that were from the Civ community, and we had the top 10 list, and they talked about the ocean specifically, and they had said that, well, people, if it was green, they would associate that with acid, and if it was yellow, they would associate that with the kiddie pool.
Yeah.
So,
for me, I think there's some people that will automatically associate a color with the convention, but I like to think gamers have the potential to overcome that, especially sci-fi gamers who are like, oh, Star Trek had a red sky episode. I just accepted there was more rust in the atmosphere. That was enough for me.
And by the way, the other point on the biomes is that they each have their own music.
There is that. I forget that.
Well, the Arid soundtrack has some parts to it that sound a lot like Fallout New Vegas. So.
Yeah. There is where I'm getting the association for good things in desert.
Yeah, it must be good. An important aspect to it, because it's not just how it looks, it's how it sounds.
So if we want new biomes, we're going to have to wait for them to give us music assets as well as art assets.
Exactly. You need both. But I'm not sure about the ice biome Hoth thing, because, I mean, there is the map type that has a lot of ice and snow and tundra and
stuff
like
that. Yeah, there's that one that's like the locked world where it's half desert, half ice.
Yeah.
That's open access, I think it's called.
So it's kind of like, to do it, they would have to come up with brand new biome style things. And frankly, if the whole game's getting played on snow with a little bit of tundra around, then it's going to be a much more boring game. Because you're not going to be able to do much for most of the game until you get terraforming.
Right. I love terraforming the desert for giggle factor. I'm like, that's not a desert. That's a lush Garden Eden here.
Recorded for episode 214 with Dan Q, Makalua, the main team, Mad Jin, and Teprock.
So we had to get another Phyrexicon panel, this time about selecting music.
I'm Griffin Cohen. I'm the lead audio designer for Beyond Earth.
I'm Jeff Knorr, lead composer on Beyond Earth. Done a lot of stuff with the Civ 5 releases, expansion packs with the original music. So
a little bit of Civilization 5, how we approach the music, and a little bit about the sound design, and then move more into Beyond Earth and kind of the differences between the two and our approach to both projects.
How they selected music for Civilization V, and then how they ended up selecting music for Civilization Beyond Earth.
for Civ 5, we knew we wanted to have a consistent kind of sound across the game, but have that cultural sound be a part of it. So orchestral would set that kind of even tone across everything, but then infuse it with these flares of different ethnicities, the different cultures that you would run across. We wanted it to loosely follow the gameplay state, basically war or peace. And a huge goal that we had as a Civ game, it's extremely replayable, and it's very different every time that you play. So you're going to end up playing it many, many times. And ideally, we don't want the music to become too repetitive, too grating, that it's really a part of the experience. We really tried make it not grating, to make it part of the experience. For the leader music, since it's based in history, we decided, well, let's base our music off of something that already exists that's a part of these cultures. So we decided to use themes that, if it's a country that still exists, they would hear that theme and recognize it, or it would be something that they're proud of, that there would be that kind of national pride in the melody, or in the case of an ancient Civ, something that's well known in history that a historian would recognize as being well known.
Yeah, that helps with the whole immersion factor. So as they were saying, people who are living in those countries, or at least from those countries, have some connection to that, they're going to be able to recognize that, and it's authentic. Which, of course, posed a challenge, because taking the same approach in Beyond Earth, short of getting in a DeLorean and jumping into the future, you see, kids, there are these series of movies. That was going to be a bit more difficult.
That should be required watching in school.
Moving on to Beyond Earth, we had some pretty different design decisions and goals we wanted to achieve. So right off the bat, the kind of broadest scope of the setting is, of course, completely different. So we're moving from kind of a purely historical setting, takes you through known history, and we're starting in a few hundred years into the future. How do we capture that? It's a Civ game, so we knew we wanted to keep the orchestral music alive and well, but we wanted to kind of infuse it with electronic elements and some kind of otherworldly elements as well. A really important part was making sure that the themes present in the game were going to be really, really memorable. So our goal was to write melodies that the player could kind of walk away from the game and hum or whistle in their head. If that happens, then we did our jobs. We wanted the music to be tied to the biomes that you're playing on, so that each planet would have its own theme and developments of that theme. And that kind of helped tie into the narrative of the game. We wanted the sound design to help inform the affinity choices that you're making. Affinities being one of the biggest systems in Beyond Earth, kind of choosing where your civilization is going to go down technologically. We wanted the sound design to support that. And as far as the leaders go, it's a little different in the sense that even though the leaders are all internationally represented, for the most part, they speak a mix of English and their native tongues, and they have a lot of kind of native idiosyncrasies in their language. This kind of helps give them a lot of character.
The balance for between licensed and original music.
There's no way we could have written 15 hours of original music in scope of the development. So we had to go searching for pieces that would fit with the orchestral, ethnically infused, but not solely ethnic feel that we were going with. And we ended up with four regions to try to piece licensed music into: European, what we call the Americas in a Civ game, which would be more of your Native American type music, and then Middle Eastern and Asian. And we ended up, after months and months of searching and listening and deciding, I think around 15 hours or so of music, with the idea that this would help fill out the playlists. And we had this section called Neutral, which were pieces we felt could go either towards peace or war, to basically make those playlists a lot longer. Gameplay, the music behavior is exploration based. So you start your game, you hear your piece theme, because that's all you know right now is your Civ. And then as you start to expand outward to explore the world, you'll hear other regions, licensed music, you'll hear other leaders' music.
I gotta admit, when they talked about the mix of English and their own languages, I really had this flashback to Firefly.
And you wonder why everyone wasn't speaking Chinese?
Exactly.
Yeah. Forums love having chats about what leaders are talking about in what language.
Yeah, the mix of language is theoretically a good idea, but it ends up sounding just weird. I don't think it worked very well, but it was a good idea.
The music development specifically for milestones and affinities, setting the music for biomes.
Kind of wrench in the works for this is what we call the event system. And this lets us tie specific pieces of music to kind of milestones that we defined that your civilization may or may not reach over the course of a game. just to give you an example, the first time your Civ launches a satellite should be a pretty momentous occasion. And so that'll interrupt the current music playing and play this kind of specific track we curated and in some cases specifically composed for those events. Each affinity has its kind of own sound identity, and these reinforce, of course, the look of the units and the visual effects.
So just to bring everything to a close, we wanted the whole game to have a consistent sound, from sound design to music to ambient music to all these decisions. We wanted to have this kind of consistent feel, this consistent tone as you're progressing through. We tried to choose unique instruments or unique electronics that would give that biome its own kind of musical sound, that you would really feel a difference as you play as different biomes. The soundtrack would sound a little bit different. And we ended up going with a theme and variations type of design, where early in the game you would hear a very clear presentation of the theme, and then as you hit important milestones through the game, you would hear variations of that theme that kind of emphasize those milestones.
We also have ambient music that's mostly electronic, also variations on these same themes, but kind of tied more closely to the environment. And then we have a set of common music as well that's biome agnostic, so you'll hear that regardless of the biome that you're playing on. And it helps fill out the soundtrack, plays into some other parts of the music as well. So the way the music's structured in the game, it's kind of a few systems at play here. The first kind of overarching one is we're able to divide the music into what we call early, middle, and late music. And this is supposed to kind of follow your trajectory through the game. So in the early game, we wanted specific types of music to be able to play. But by the time you get to the late part of the game, where you're kind of more familiar with the planet, there's more stuff open to you, you can visibly just see more, we introduce new music throughout the course of it.
Today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
I'm dying for a fourth affinity. I've been hoping for causality, the time travel victory. They gotta do it.
Woo-hoo.
First expansion.
There's some issues with the three affinities we have. We don't need a fourth affinity in the mix right now.
The confused things. Yeah, I know.
And if it was kind of one of those, well, once you go down one particular affinity, that's it. You're locked out of the other two, kind of like certain social policies were in Civilization V. Yeah, then I'd have more of an issue saying, then we need more choices in that case.
Right.
But in this, because we can mix and match, it's...
It helps, because you can do a little bit of both. So I try to explain myself why I'm going purity and harmony. And I can only think, I guess I have pets that are alien life forms, because that one quest that mentions it.
You can go purity, but you can have a little supremacy in your life, a little harmony on the side.
Some of your friends are robots, too.
A little bit of purity is all I need.
No. I know where you're
going. No, not really.
I was surprised I had this quote so many lyrics from that song before anybody said anything. I was kind of disappointed.
No, I was just facepalming over here.
We had to finish the facepalming first.
I knew where you were going.
Yeah.
Band and song lyrics.
That's only because you know me.
You think you know me.
Are you going to start singing Simply Red now, if you don't know me by now?
No. Something different entirely.
There's not enough singing on Polycast. I make a move.
No.
Yeah.
Overrule.
No, man. You cannot overrule. You haven't won yet.
Won this thing off.
On the next episode of Polycast, you can only answer a topic if you sing it.
I'm thinking of that.
Then you'll lose, Mackie, and then you won't ever be able to regulate who sings.
Fine, let's compromise for Mackie. Next episode of Polycast, we can only answer in song lyrics.
Okay.
That'd be interesting. I can make notes,
right? Oh, God.
Mackie wants to be a regulator?
Wait, what?
Yes. Yes, she does. Yes.
Okay.
I think I'd have to go to rap to get the best words to answer
them. Oh, no.
That's amazing, yeah.
Polycast is set to return in 2015 for season 9. We're running out of single digits. Uh-oh. I am a regular co-host, Dan Q, and I've been joined by guest co-host, Darkest Onion.
And I almost never have anything to say at the end, so I'll say nothing.
Fellow regular co-host, Mad Jin.
What?
The mean team.
See, guys, I am pure, technically.
And Makalua.
I can't even.
Nice. I just know.
I'm sorry. I'm still sitting here face palming over Phil. I don't have anything.
Success!
Oracle face palm cannon deployed.
Record day December 6th, 2014. Phyroxicon Panel Clips, copyright 2K Games. Civilization Online Music, copyright 2K Games. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.